Good morning. I'm Ron Latz, State Senator from St. Louis Park. I'm the chair of the Senate Judiciary and Public Safety Committee and the co-chair of the Judiciary, Public Safety, and Civil Law Conference Committee. I'm joined here by our wonderful vice chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Senator Claire Umover-Bayton. We are very proud that today we are going to pass an $880 million investment in keeping Minnesotans safer. We have a well-balanced approach to public safety in this bill, long-reaching efforts to prevent crime from the beginning of the notion of keeping our communities safe and all the way to the end, supporting victims when crimes do occur. Everywhere in between, we've got investments in finding criminals who commit crimes, in holding them accountable in the criminal justice system, and providing adequate resources for their constitutional rights to be protected every step along the way, bolstering the crime lab investments to decrease evidence turnaround and violent crime investigative resources to find those who do commit crimes, and make sure that the entire system works well, and in the end that we get as much justice as we possibly can, which means holding those accountable with longer sentences for those who do commit crimes, and it also means finding out where they may have targeted the wrong person and exonerating those who are accused. And on the far back end, we've got additional policy in this bill to give prosecutors the opportunity to take another look at sentencing for those who were sentenced years ago under older statutes and that may have improved their lives themselves and while in prison, while as juveniles who committed crimes and as older folks who committed crimes, for a relook at some of those sentences. So this is a wide-ranging bill. It's, I think, a really well-balanced and forward-looking approach to criminal justice. Criminal justice has two main components. As I see it, one is holding people accountable and punishing them for the offenses that they commit. And the other is, once they're in a prison system, is finding a way to rehabilitate them if they possibly can. Because 95% of these people who go into prison are going to be released back into the communities. So we are also bolstering the resources within the Department of Corrections to expand treatment, create an incentive-based system for the inmates to participate and successfully complete this treatment. That incentive is to reduce the amount of time they spend in prison. A really large investment in community corrections so that when they are out of prison and back in the communities, we have the resources in place to support their successful reintegration into the community so they are less likely to commit new crimes. This is overall, I think, a bill that will make Minnesotans safer, and I'm very proud that we will pass it today. I'd like to turn this over to my vice chair, Senator Umover-Bayton, for some remarks as well.
Good morning. I'm Senator Claire Umover-Bayton, and I represent District 66 and serve as the vice chair of the Judiciary and Public Safety Committee. And I just want to thank Senator Latz for all of his hard work on this committee, bringing us all together, really listening to the entire caucus, especially the newest members of our caucus, to build such a comprehensive package. And I'm really proud of the bill that we're going to pass today. Being one of the first Black women in the Senate and the daughter of an immigrant, I've really been able to shape legislation around my own experiences and those of my community. And serving on this committee, it's just been an honor to champion criminal justice reform and look at the really necessary changes to a system that has disproportionately harmed people of color. And we've developed, I think, a transformational package that is really going to create safer communities and support Minnesotans. And so just as we're putting those resources towards addressing crime, we really need to put resources towards preventing it in the first place. As Senator Latz spoke to, you know, the money that we have in this bill for youth intervention is really game-changing and I think desperately needed. And youth intervention specifically has just such an astounding high return on investment, and we know it really improves public safety and prevents crime in the future. There's also community crime prevention grants. There's an Office of Youth Restorative Practices. The Minnesota Connecting Families legislation, that was my bill to provide incarcerated folks and their families access to free phone calls and stop the really shameful process of the department collecting commissions on that. And we know that when incarcerated people and their loved ones are connected, they're just going to be that much more likely to succeed and go home due to those familial bonds. And I think when it comes to policing, we're really supporting best practices here that are supporting law enforcement, keeping them safe and keeping our communities that they serve safe as well. On the policy side, we have a number of housing provisions that are going to level the playing field between tenants and landlords, help more Minnesotans access housing, and really reduce the burden on our courts to help avoid evictions in the first place. So, you know, overall, I think this package really addresses the root of the problem. There's targeted investments, resources, and great policies just to keep our community safe.
Question? Senator Latz, can you talk about the extreme risk and background check provisions? I was wondering if there was, like, you know, one or two changes that you all made along the way or toward the end that helped kind of cinch the deal on that, or was it less changes and more just conversations and discussions? The bill didn't seem to be substantially different from what the Senate had considered earlier in the year.
The core features of both of those bills, the background checks and the red flag bills, are as they were introduced. It was not just a matter of letting circumstances play out. We had intentional and wide-ranging conversations, we meaning me, others involved in the process, legislators, and including especially the legislators who came into the Senate uncertain about what approach they would take to these bills and trying to weigh the interests of their districts and their and the policy. And we made changes in the bills in response to them. They brought a keen eye toward the language and to the policy provisions, the final product is better because we had that deliberative process with individual senators. For example, there is one provision in the in the red flag bill that originally provided for the subject of the order to go back into court on an annual basis to seek a change in the order. And because of our conversations with members, we made that every 6 months instead of every year. The penalty on the background checks for a seller not having the paperwork reflecting the certificate or the permit to purchase, based on conversations, went from a gross misdemeanor to a misdemeanor. The length of retention for that paperwork went from 20 years down to 10 years. So these are important improvements to these bills that are a result of the input from the particularly the new members in the Senate this year. But the core features of the bills are completely intact. And I will tell you also one other thing. There are those who try to rush through changes in legislation. And these bills have been around, geez, I've been working on these things for 20 years since I was elected in 2002 into the House. And the background check bill especially has gone through a wholesale change in its approach from a put every transaction through an FFL to a permit to purchase with an annual renewal and an unlimited number of firearms that can be bought and so on. And that lengthy process, while frustrating because I think we would have saved a lot of lives along the way had we passed these a long time ago, I think the final product that I expect we will pass today is better because it went through an extensive process of stakeholder input, community input, and legislative input.
When it comes to the extreme extreme risk orders, there's two tiers. There's the emergency one, and then there's a standard one. Is the expectation that all of these will go through both stages, or will do you expect a certain percentage will go through the one that does have more court process on the front end?
That's really hard to predict. It's going to be on a situation-by-situation basis. We know that both pathways are used in other states. There are 19 other states now that have red flag bills, states run by Republican legislatures and governors, and states run by Democratic legislatures and governors. And it's impossible to predict. What we are going to be providing, finally, is a path forward for families and law enforcement who know that someone is exhibiting signs of crisis and danger. And it will give them lawful tools to separate the people in crisis from the firearms that are around them in their bedstand or in their night table or in their own homes. They haven't had that path up until now, unless they affirmatively started taking steps to commit a crime. And it's been frustrating for law enforcement and frustrating for families who call law enforcement and say, my son or daughter or brother is having a serious emotional or mental health crisis, and he's surrounded by guns, and we're afraid he's going to either kill himself or kill others. Might be out and be a mass shooting. That's why this is called a red flag bill, because there are signs ahead of time, red flags, that there's a serious risk here. And when they call the police come and say, well, he's just sitting there doing fine at the moment. There's nothing we can do. With the enactment of this law, there will be something they can do. They can go in and get an emergency ex parte order, or if the crisis is not quite so imminent, but there's still a great deal of concern, they can go in and get an order following a hearing. Either way, there is the entitlement of the respondent, the subject of the order, to a full-blown judicial hearing with all the due process.
Well, the civil legal aid part of this bill, is that still in the bill, right?
Yes, it is. yes, about a 84% increase in funding for civil legal aid. It really is game-changing.
It is.
Because they've been they've got this pent-up demand that they haven't been able to address. Is that what's going on?
Yeah. You know, we heard from our folks in civil legal services some really emotional testimony just around the need, how many folks need to access these services, folks that they aren't able to provide services with right now. They're the lowest paid in our system, and we want to get that salary parity, and we just want to make sure that folks have representation. People, you know, deserve that in order to get their day in court. So I'm really proud. I carried the Civil Legal Services appropriation on the Senate side, and I think we made game-changing investments there, and it's really going to help Minnesotans.
Opponents of some of these gun measures have made the counterpoint that, prosecutors, law enforcement, like there should be enforcement of laws already in the books related to gun crimes. And I know that I think it was Mike Freeman in Hennepin County said it's impossible to build a case that would result in serious penalties for straw purchases, which would address illegal guns. And I know your initial proposal had, I believe, removing discretion from judges or removing the discretion so they'd have to enforce mandatory minimums for gun crimes. Why was that taken out, and is there anything on the straw purchases, increasing penalties for straw purchases?
There was an amendment passed on the Senate floor, which was not part of the House bill, that imposed mandatory minimum penalties for convictions for certain gun crimes. We took the House position on that. I personally am opposed in principle to mandatory minimum sentences because they end up applying across the board regardless of circumstances involved in a case, and makes it very, very difficult for justice to be served or found in any individual case. That's not to say I wouldn't personally take a hard line on someone who violated certain gun crimes, but as a statewide policy, I think mandatory minimum sentences here and in all other places in our statute as well are not appropriate. On straw purchases, I'd have to double check actually as to whether we increased the penalty. I think we did, but I'd want to double check on that. I carried the at Mike Freeman's request actually a number of years ago. I carried the bill and enacted it into law to increase the penalty for straw purchases. The most difficult part of straw purchases is of enforcing the law is one of the elements of an offense, which would be ideally you could have an easy way to prove that someone knew or should have known that their purchase was done with the anticipation that the firearm was going to be used in the commission of a crime. So that's the hardest challenge to get around, but we do have strong penalties. It is a gross misdemeanor to do a straw purchase, and I want to double check. Thank you for the question, because I'll check on this for the floor as to whether there's the felony penalty is being imposed in this bill. Yeah.
And if I can just add, I think what Senator Latz did such a great job on is listening to the experts and having so much testimony, really hearing from law enforcement and families who've been impacted by gun violence and long hours, I know, because I had to chair while we heard your bills, and listening to members from both sides of the aisles and really trying to make this the best bill possible. And we know that this is what Minnesotans have been begging us for, is please take some action on gun violence. I think you did an amazing job of bringing those experts together to craft the best possible bill.
Are there any areas in our criminal justice parts of this bill where sentences are reduced or the ability to prosecute juveniles as adults is limited?
There are no changes in the bill relating to the ability to prosecute juveniles as adults. There are investments in juvenile justice. We're putting $5 million into Ramsey County to give them resources to build some new juvenile-specific physical facilities. And to make other changes in the way they address juvenile issues. I know that Hennepin County is taking a comprehensive approach as well. They did not approach us specifically for financial support this year. and we're putting a lot of money into prevention of juveniles, like the youth intervention programs and so on. We're doubling the budget for YIPA, the youth intervention programs specifically, plus there's a whole lot of other money going into less specific youth prevention programs. So I think we're taking a really far-reaching attempt here to address crimes committed by youth. There are no changes to the extended juvenile jurisdiction laws or anything like that. With regard to the question about reduction of sentences, this is a pretty well-balanced bill, in my judgment, in that regard. We've got the organized retail theft crimes, which increase the penalties, create a special statute dealing with basically RICO-type racketeering organized crime targeting retail theft and really bumping up the penalties for that. We've got a few other provisions in here also that increase criminal penalties. We have what I think is another game-changing investment or program here. It's not really an investment in the end because we expect it to be revenue neutral, is the Minnesota Rehabilitation and Reinvestment Act. And you know from the last floor debate, and it's become one of the GOP talking points, unfortunately, they say it's a get-out-of-jail-free card. And I'm going to tell you right now, that's not what it is, just like I said on the floor last time. This is an opportunity for people who are in prison to earn their way to a somewhat lower length of time serving in prison by participating in and successfully completing programs to earn their GEDs, to get college degrees, to learn workforce skills, to have a chemical dependency treatment completion, to deal with all sorts of opportunities that are available in prison but are not mandatory. And they could just sit there and wait out their time, and they'll get released at two-thirds of their sentence right now. That's the state of the law. We are creating a system here where they are going to be able to earn. Just like in the capitalist system, you do well, you make profits. Profits are your incentive. Your reward is you make money, Right here, their money is getting out of jail a little bit earlier because they have earned it, made themselves better, and thereby improve the chance that when they get back into the community, they're not going to commit new crimes, not create new victims. And the resources that are going to be saved through this also are going to be reinvested in doing exactly this kind of work in helping to prevent crime in the future.
Folks, we have a couple minutes.
In the past, there's been efforts to, and I think the Senate position had money for local law enforcement body camera grants. If I'm trying to remember, last year or in recent years, those kind of got held up because Democrats wanted some rules and regulations around releasing footage when police kill someone. Seems like we have those, some of those rules and regulations in this bill, but we don't have the money for the local law enforcement grants. And I wondered if that was just why it ended up that way.
Speak to that.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah, just on the policy piece, we wanted to create a sort of statewide policy where, you know, in those instances of deadly force being used, that families are able to access that footage within 5 days and the broader public within 14 days. I think that's really good to have that policy in place. I think, you know, our bill has both sort of those resources and grants through the Department of Public Safety. And then the thing with law enforcement is it's also sort of a local game, right? And so I know there's other proposals and other bills. You know, a lot of how cities fund that is through local government aid or those proposals for public safety aid. And we want to make sure that people have the resources. And I think we hear a lot that our local entities want to get those resources directly so they can decide how to best use those funds. So we're balancing those different approaches in this bill. I think the policy is great, and I do think there's a number of resources there, as well as looking at our overall budget that we're putting together as a state to make sure cities can access that.
How would the no-knock warrant provisions in this, this CCR compare to what's current practice?
Yeah, so I think, again, we put together a really good bill where we got feedback from families that have been impacted and lost loved ones, from law enforcement. We wanted to really limit that practice because we know that puts our officers in danger, and often the folks that are, you know, the warrant might be served on in danger. And so there are some very limited exceptions there that were laid out in the bill and that we worked with stakeholders on. I think it is the best approach to keep our community safe. So it's really around making sure that, you know, folks are a regular warrant where they're knocking and they're announcing themselves, you know, loudly. A no-knock is really only going to be acceptable in these small circumstances if, you know, you're unable to do that, if the place is unoccupied, or if, you know, someone poses a really imminent threat. And we, again, worked with all the stakeholders on that, I think, have a really good approach.
I think it's worth pointing out that the testimony we had was that the National Tactical Officers Association has reached the conclusion that no-knock warrants, generally speaking, are not necessary, and they are, in fact, more dangerous for the police officers executing the warrants as well as for any occupants of the premises. And so they have an extensive training protocol now for how to go about accomplishing the goals of the warrant without the risks involved in no-knocks. We understand there are still some departments and still some situations where they might feel that's the best route, and that's why and Senator Umover-Baton was critical in fashioning this language to keep a narrow pathway available for those circumstances where it might still be warranted.
Senator, how certain are you that there are 34 votes for this today?
I'm quite confident. We never know for sure until the votes go up on the board. But I'm quite confident, and I know part of the quite inherent in that question are two of the flashpoints, which is the gun violence reduction provisions, the background checks, and the red flag bills. I want to tell you, these provisions are enormously popular among the residents of Minnesota and across the nation. And I'm going to give you the latest data that I have here. On the proposal to require background checks on all private gun sales, 74% of Minnesotans approve of the idea, with just 21% opposed. And that's widespread, 79% urban areas, 78% in suburbs, and 62% in rural areas support background checks. On the red flag or extreme risk protection law, 63%, this is across the state of Minnesota, 63% support the proposal. Only 26% are opposed. And again, that's widespread, strong support in urban areas at 71%, suburban areas at 69%, and rural areas at 52%. So Minnesotans understand how important these are. And I hope that the legislators who vote on this today also understand it. And there's one other point I want to make in regard to this, which is critical to consider, because the opponents have long said, it's not the guns. Don't come after our guns. Right? You've all heard, you've all sat here in the press conferences where that's been their main message. These proposals do not go after the guns. They do exactly what the opponents have long said, it's the people you need to deal with. Well, that's what these proposals do. These proposals on the background check will identify the people who are under existing law are not eligible to possess firearms. The only way to find out who they are is to put them through a background check. That happens every day in FFLs right now, in the federally licensed dealers. This will expand the category of sales that are covered by that. And same with the red flags. We're separating the people who at that moment in time are not in a good place to possess firearms from the guns themselves. So we're focusing on the people issue here, and that's why these are enormously supported, well supported, and why I'm certain, and the evidence supports this conclusion, that they will be effective in reducing firearm deaths from suicide and homicide in Minnesota.
All right, folks, we got to keep the senators on schedule. Debate starts in the 2 o'clock hour this afternoon.
Thank you.
Thank you.